It is a real privilege and a pleasure for me to be here, both at the University of Michigan and also on this tremendous topic of truth in today's world. I think after the first day, much of which was at Eastern Michigan, the question I'd been asked most was nothing about academia or the social sciences at all. It was whether I was related to the Guinness Brewery. And most people who asked me were actually surprised when the answer was yes. They were kidding. I often get into sort of trouble over that in various places. And so have my ancestors. One of my ancestors is a very generous philanthropist in the last century in Dublin. And he did lots for the homeless and various things in Ireland, but he also rebuilt St. Patrick's Cathedral. And the city fathers invited him to the unveiling of the new cathedral and said that they were going to say a little something to him on one of the windows. And he was a Christian believer too. But to his horror, when they unveiled the window, they put at the bottom of it a text from the Bible. "I was thirsty and you gave me to drink." Sort of the Irish city fathers and their hermeneutics somewhat screwed up. A few years ago, I was in London at a conference, and the other speaker was E.F. Schumacher, Fritz Schumacher, the then well-known economist and the author of the best-selling book, Small is Beautiful. And he began his lecture with this story. He'd been in Leningrad, he said, when the Soviet Union was still there, and he'd been trying to follow where he was with a map, but he just couldn't figure out where he was with the buildings because they just didn't fit what he saw on the map in front of himself. All around him were huge Russian Orthodox churches with their great golden domes, but none of them were on the map. Seeing him puzzled, the guide came over to him and said, "Oh, that's simple. We just don't mark churches on the map." "Oh, yes, you do," said Schumacher. "Look, there's one right here." "Oh, no," she said, "that's not a church now. That's a museum. It's living churches we don't mark on the map." Schumacher, who was a Christian, said, "That wasn't the first time I felt in my life that the maps of life and knowledge I'd been given all the time I grew up often just didn't fit the things that were there right in front of my eyes, and especially the things about which I cared so much and made so much importance in my life as an economist." Peter Berger, the professor of social sciences, has often remarked that the United States is a nation of Indians ruled by Swedes, by which he means that the American people are as religious as India, the most religious country in the world, and yet the American leadership is often as secular as Sweden, the most secular country in the world, and many of the American misunderstandings, tensions, and frictions come from that disparity. Now, neither he nor I believe that that's a result of hostility, but simply what Max Weber calls tone deafness. That many of the leaders in our society, including many in the universities, are unmusical when it comes to faith. And they have no idea of the music and the score by which millions of their contemporaries and their ancestors live. Consider this. Many of the greatest minds and scientists and artists and musicians and poets and reformers in the whole Western world have been followers of Christ. For example, Augustine, Pascal, Rembrandt, Johann Sebastian Bach, Isaac Newton, Dostoevsky, Jonathan Edwards, William Wilberforce. And yet today, many American thinkers think that faith is for the uneducated and the uncultured. Or again, consider this. For most of America's history, most people in the past and today have understood themselves and their lives from the perspective of their faith in Christ. More than 85% of Americans still do. And yet in certain parts of American public life, the very mention of faith is considered undemocratic, intrusive, and beneath consideration. Or again, consider this. Almost all of the great movements of reform in this country, including the abolition of slavery, civil rights, and the rise of the women's movement have not only been inspired by people of faith, but led by people of faith. And yet somehow today, faith is considered reactionary. Now I say this not in anger, but in deep sorrow. Many American leaders simply do not understand the things considered the deepest things in life by most people in human history. For that reason tonight, rather than give an academic lecture, coming out of one discipline, depending on a certain rigorous logic and so on, I want just to give you one person's description of the journey, thinking people's quest for meaning. And in my experience, how many have come to faith in Christ? People with profound minds, with a real integrity in all their searching. I've been a follower of Christ for 35 years. Had the privilege as a traveler, as a reporter, as a writer, being in most of the continents of this world, studying in various universities, visiting others, interviewing prime ministers, presidents, meeting people like gurus and all sorts of radicals and people, and seeing many, many people in all the ups and downs and twists and turns of life, searching as to what's the meaning of life. And I'd just like to describe, as far as is possible, a thinking person's quest for meaning. Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying this is the only way to faith, although there's any required way to faith. There are as many ways to faith in Christ as there are people who come to faith in Christ. I'm not saying this is a proof for God, not at all. I actually don't believe in the theistic proofs, philosophically speaking. But this is more, in the limits of a short time, a series of pointers for anyone who takes these things seriously. I'm not saying for a moment that this argument is exhaustive, but I do hope it's sufficient for anyone to pick it up for their own reflection. I'm not in any way trying to claim a demonstration of faith for spectators, which is a very disastrous notion anyway. Because the quest itself requires not demonstration, but participation. People getting into the questions, following through for themselves, and coming to their own conclusions. But start with the very notion of the idea of journey itself. We all know the opening words of Dante's Divine Comedy. Midway on our life's journey, I found myself in a dark woods. Think of the Hebrew Exodus, or Homer's Odyssey, or Virgil's Aeneid, or Dante's Divine Comedy, or John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, or Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, or in our own time, Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha. You see that right throughout history, across all the ages and the continents, one of the deepest and most universal pictures of life is of a journey, a quest, a pilgrimage, a personal odyssey, and at its heart, the deep desire to find meaning, and above all, the deep desire to find a human home. If you asked what the 20th century was characterized by, many people wouldn't think that it was movement and travel. But it is. Yes, the space conquests. Yes, the darkness of Auschwitz. But as one of the major sub-themes behind these glorious or dark events has been the fact that our century has been a century of travel and of movement and migration, of banishment and exile and emigres and immigrants and vagabonds and bums, and you see it, across the board, people traveling. Mexican wetbacks crawling through California ravines. Vietnamese bobbing in the South China Seas to escape tyranny. Terrified Tutsis crossing the borders from the Hutus. Turkish guest workers scrambling into Germany. Travel, exile, movement, senior executives, the new aristocracy of brains, as they're called, so different from the old aristocracy of blood. The old aristocracy with local roots and local allegiances, but the new elite. See them with their cellular telephones and their cases drawn behind them like little pets rushing across airports with their busy calendars, on the move, in transit, much of the 20th century is profoundly on the move. Now, of course, this has its advantages. Here we are in a nation of immigrants. Give me your tired, give me your poor, give me your huddled masses. We know, too, that many of the greatest insights in our world were from those who were exiles. Dante, exiled from Florence. Keats, writing many of his best poems, exiled from England. Hemingway in Paris, T.S. Eliot in London, Solzhenitsyn in Vermont, Einstein in Princeton. A century on the move has created great insights, but also great restlessness and great homelessness. Think of the myth of the wandering Dutchman. Think of the tragedy of the wandering Jew feeling at home nowhere in a precarious world. But as you think that way, you see that far deeper than physical travel, far deeper than geographical movement, is the fact that people have always seen that movement and travel and journeying is the most profound picture of human life. Here we are, 70 years or 10, give or take a few. And do we ask why? Do we ask where have we come from? Where are we going? What does it mean to have home? What are the dangers? What are the diversions that may mean we lose our way, or maybe worse still, lose our very lives and our souls? From Plato, with his idea that the human being was an exile, to a modern poet like Jacob Brodsky, saying that homelessness is a metaphysical condition. You can see that some of the deepest understandings of humanness grows out of this desire to move towards wherever that human home is. Now you'd think if that was so, though we pick up a saying like Socrates, the unexamined life is worth living, and we all be examining everything. But the fact is, that's perhaps the most quoted, least followed saying in all classical antiquity. And even today, even in intellectual circles, there are many who never give a thought about the deepest issues of life. And you have to say with sadness in many circles that to examine life today is a tough thing in an often unexamining age. But as Walker Percy says very simply, you can get all A's and still flunk life. Or as G.K. Chesterton said earlier at the turn of the century, human beings have always lost their way. The tragedy today is we've also lost our address. Or as Augustine said, with maybe the most famous words outside the Bible from a Christian perspective, speaking to God, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. But let me describe to you what I think are the four stages that most people who take thinking seriously and question seriously pass through on the journey of life in the search of faith. Stage one, clarifying your position, there is a time for questions. Becoming aware of a sense of questioning and need that forces us to consider where we are in life is the first stage, because it spurs us to look for meaning. It spurs us to look for answers beyond the answers we have now, and therefore we become searchers, because what constitutes the seeker is the questions and the needs that spur them beyond what they were satisfied with before. Some decades have it very strongly. Those of us who were students in the 60s remember the old film Alfie. What's it all about, Alfie? But there aren't many asking that explicitly today, and yet people are in 100 implicit ways. Now let me underscore. To believe in God is not the product of needs or questions, no. Rather, we disbelieve in what we believed in before, which our new questions and needs have exploded. So we don't believe in God because of needs, but we begin to search because we've begun to disbelieve. Malcolm Muggeridge, the great English journalist, his biographer said of him, he knew what he disbelieved long before he knew what he believed, and that is what made him search. Now think of some of the things that that entails. First, that each of us as human beings has a drive for meaning in life. for what's called very often a philosophy of life, a worldview, which in essence is a world within a world, which to us makes a world of difference. Because all that we see, we interpret through that world. Seen one way, we all have a deep need of meaning and belonging. We need to make sense of our universe. We need to find security in our world. And that profound drive and need for meaning and belonging gives people all the various worldviews. Call them what you like, philosophy of life or whatever. As C.S. Lewis says, I believe in Christianity as I believe in the sun. Not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. With some people it's conscious, with some it's unconscious. With some it's a matter of serious choice, with some they've inherited it from their background or their parents or whatever. Some are quite open. Their worldview is their own creation, self-invention, fiction if you like. With others, after serious search, they give it the status of something given to them from outside human experience, the product of revelation. People have seen worldviews in all sorts of ways. Plato described it as a raft through which you sail through life and survive the storms. Lucretius said that it was fear that made the gods. And as we all know, Marx said the religion is the opium of the people. Freud said that religion is an illusion, a crutch, a projection. Henrik Ibsen, the Norwegian poet, said, take away the life lie from the average man, not the lifeline, the life lie, and you take away his happiness. It's all pure fiction. Aldous Huxley described his search for his own worldview as scooping out a cave of illuminated meaning in the wider, limitless world of irrationality and meaninglessness. But we all have that in some way. Maybe the greatest picture of it all in human thinking is Plato's description of the cave. You remember it. Human beings, he said, are chained so we cannot move our heads or our legs. Behind us, so that we cannot turn around and see it, is the opening of the cave through which the light streams. Behind us, more immediately, is a gap and a road and a wall. And behind the wall, people in the distance are moving along and talking quietly as they move. So all we can see are the reflections on the cave wall in front of us, and the shadows we take as reality, the dim echoes we hear we take as speech and communication. Is that all our worldview is? A shadowy picture? Is it pure fiction, as many have said, or can it be actually true because it's revealed and disclosed? It matters. Take the famous book by Viktor Frankl about man's search for meaning. In Auschwitz, he said, as a psychologist, it was clear that those who had a sense of future, those who had a sense of hope, those who had a sense of why they were there, they could bear even Auschwitz. But those who lost hope, those with no sense of why, and those with no sense of future, finally grew listless. It wasn't that they were beaten worse than the others. They finally laid down, and many of them just simply died. Because men need meaning. Voltaire said, when human beings give up hope, death becomes a duty. Elie Wiesel went through Auschwitz and said, no, when the Jew gives up hope, he invents new hope, because we need hope for meaning. And what's true in the extreme boundary conditions of life is true for all of us. We live in this world making sense of ourselves, of right and wrong, of reality and fantasy, and 100 other things, and we do so within this worldview which is ours. The second thing you see is, why don't people think more seriously about worldviews? If they're this important and this universal, you'd think everyone would be searching all the time. And many have said, why are so many human beings very careless and live the unexamined life which is supposed not to be worth living? Various obvious answers. One is maybe that worldviews are rather like health. When you have it, you're not aware of it. You're much more aware of it when you lose your health, and the same with a worldview. Another obvious reason is many people defer to the experts, the authorities. In the old days, the priests, whoever today, the doctor, the psychiatrist, the professor, whoever. But a far deeper reason is this, as many have explored, that human beings have an inbuilt resistance to realizing that we need meaning because we're going to die. And this life is short. And the two main strategies by which human beings drown out the darkness, as it were, is one, what Pascal called diversion, and the other, what many people have simply called bargaining. Pascal is the most original and the first. Look at human beings. The sole cause of human unhappiness, he says, is that man does not know how to stay alone in his own room. If we were really happy, we wouldn't divert ourselves. But because we divert ourselves, we have to do it to keep ourselves from facing our finitude, facing our death. So entertainment, busyness, activism, frenetic this, frenetic that, and his descriptions of 17th century courtiers and so on are dwarfed by our modern possibilities with Walkmans and all sorts of things, everything to drown out. Here's a universe of which we have to make sense. And 70 years and 10 and not many more, we'll die. And what did it all add up to? We would rather divert ourselves. The second is bargaining. We calculate, we put it off. And if we're really the grand Promethean souls, we want to bargain with life, bargain with fate, even bargain with the devil, maybe even sell our souls. So we know Christopher Marlowe's Faust, Goethe's Faust, Thomas Mann's Faust, the soul-selling bargains of people who wanted to calculate, who did not want to die, and they tried to do it and defy even death to get knowledge or sex or whatever it was they were after. But that's not just literature. Take, say, Michel Foucault, who when he died in 1984 was maybe the most famous, notorious intellectual in the world. Foucault died of AIDS. And Foucault describes his risking AIDS in the San Francisco bathhouses as a deliberate Faustian bargain. Foucault writes, quote, "Sex is worth dying for." And you read his diary and he says this: the risk is there, because in 84 they knew what the promiscuity in the bathhouses was beginning to mean. He still went there. He says the risk is its own reward. Sex is so much to me, he says, better to flirt with death than face the boredom of the alternative. And he did it to the last throw of the dice, and he died. But why is it that people, despite all this, still think and start to search in life? One reason is just the passages of life. The quick, inspiring idealism when we're young is often shouldered aside by our activism and our confidence in middle age, which itself is cowed into silence by the faint tolling bells of our mortality, thickening waistline, growing wrinkles, graying hair, and so on. That's obvious. Another reason people think is just the contradictions. Take, say, Arthur Koestler and those who describe communism as the God that failed. The sheer internal historical contradictions of Marxism, for them back in the 40s, for many more recently, brought the whole belief down until they saw it was the God that failed and they had to look elsewhere for meaning system. But many of the most serious and fascinating searchers are those who are jolted by experience. I was describing this afternoon, but let me just pick up a couple. For example, the intimation of damnation. What do I mean? Take W.H. Auden, the great poet. He says that when he moved to the United States in the late 1930s, he had been a Marxist, he'd been a Freudian, and he was a liberal. He said what was common to all those philosophies was an optimistic view of human nature. Take away this, the state, that, the other, whatever, and human goodness would emerge and flourish. And that was his worldview. And what shattered him was one experience. In 1938, he went into a cinema in Manhattan in Yorkville, the area of New York, where many of the German speakers lived. And he went, and they went, to watch a film on the Nazi invasion of Poland. And as the panzers rolled in and the Poles were flattened, evidently some of the German speakers in the cinema shouted out, "Kill them! Kill them!" And this went on for much of the documentary. And Auden listened with a horrified reaction. This was a denial of everything in him that was humanist in his values. And then he suddenly realized he had no view of human nature, to account for that. What's worse, he had no absolute by which to judge that as wrong. And he said he left the cinema with a clear sense of the fatal flaw of liberalism of that time, with its romantic view of human beings, and he went on search for a perspective by which he could judge wrong as wrong. Peter Berger puts it simply like this. Have you ever heard someone say, "God damn it," and really mean it? I don't use that word apart from that illustration. Most people use that word only casually as trivial blasphemy. But some people don't. Why? They face evil which is so evil that however they've been trained, they've got to say, "God damn it," even if they're atheists. Aren't we taught through psychology to be non-judgmental? Doesn't everything in our studies, and certainly here too, tell us that nothing's absolute, all is relative? Play those ideas out to the end of the line if you like. There are still experiences so evil in life that people say, "God damn it." They may be atheists, but they know intuitively here is something so wrong it needs an absolute judgment, whether or not they have the philosophical basis. Something in them is a signal that's bleeping beyond what they now believe, and they begin the search. C.S. Lewis gives us another example of a very different kind. The argument of surprise by joy. Lewis says in his own life, you can read in his autobiography, he had many, many experiences, and many people do too, of desires that are unsatisfied, that are more desirable than all the satisfactions we have in life. And every time they come, they leave us with an intense longing, an intense wistfulness for a scent that we've never yet smelt, for music that we've never yet heard, a desire for home that we've never quite experienced, but we long for. News of a country we've never yet visited. Oh yes, he says, you can call it beauty. You can call it nostalgia. You can think, if I went back to that, I'd remember it. No, he says, go back to that, and what you think you're remembering is yet another desire for an equally intense yearning for something beyond. And whether it's the argument of the first, the need for something to judge evil as evil, or the need for something that fulfills that intense desire for joy. Even Nietzsche said, joy wills eternity, deep, deep eternity. Many people have these experiences in life, however careless and complacent, and suddenly they become searchers. Stage one. Took more time on that than the others. Let me move on. Stage two. Choosing your map and guide, a time not for questions, but for answers. Stage two comes when, in seeking answers to specific needs and specific questions, we look at a full range of possible answers and slowly close on that one which we begin to believe is the answer to our question, to our need. Now, clearly, the second stage is the one that's most often associated with seeking. Active looking, comparing. Notice some features of it. First, it is conceptual. You eventually need a practical answer, but this is a time to look at ideas, look at beliefs, look at claims for this, that, and the other. Very, very conceptual stage when people are weighing up and considering. Second, notice that it's comparative. It's kind of like window shopping. I want a suit, but this one, that one, the other one, I'm not sure. I look at them all to weigh them up, to compare them, to consider them. And in the way, often unconsciously, searchers are looking through life, reading here, talking there, a cup of coffee there, asking the question here, and all the time underneath, they're comparing. Does this answer that I meet have the answer to the question that I have? Does it provide the resolution to the problem that is truly mine? The third thing you notice at this stage, it's conditional. There's always an ifness. A detached, if I believe that, would it make a difference? So I'm listening, there's a cocked ear. There's always, I want to be sure first, and an arm's length to the whole process. But equally, it's channeled. You might think, as many people think, that far too many religions and philosophies and therapies and seminars and so on, free lifetimes and endless resources, and you never get to the end of them. But you forget, the searcher has questions, not just any question, but this question, that need, this problem. And whether consciously or unconsciously, there's a focus, there's a channel to the search, because they want answers to that which is truly troubling them at a deep, deep level. Now, obviously at this stage, infinite number of big questions come up. The origins of the universe. The fact is that there's a God or not. The nature of human beings. The nature of the problems of human beings. The possibility of liberation, or if you like, salvation for human beings. And the destiny of human beings and of the universe. An enormous range of questions. Let me just, though, ask you to think of one tonight. The human dilemma of evil and of suffering and death. And I don't mean I'm tackling that, but keep that one as the focus of your thinking. And for many people, that is the deepest one. Particularly in a century like ours, which is the most murderous century in all human history. How do you have an answer to life that can really look Auschwitz in the eye? On the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, that was actually Arnold Lustig's question on NPR. He was a survivor of Auschwitz. He said, I would like to take every human being alive and give them at least one day, or maybe 1 hour, and at least 1 second of Auschwitz as it was, with the guarantee they wouldn't die, and see how they would face it and answer it. And he said that should be a maturity test for anyone growing out of their teenage years into adulthood. That's a good test. And the answers are there. And it's our responsibility to face them. And you know the big answers as well as I do. Take, say, Buddhism. And I believe you should look at each of these from their own prophets. Look at them at their best. And I'm not going to give a critique of it, but just think quickly. Gautama Buddha, the 6th century. Wealthy, careless, goes out on this trip, sees the dying man, sees the aging man, sees the sick man, and starts to search. And 6 years later, his so-called enlightenment under the peepal tree at Bodh Gaya. And you remember the great fourfold truths. That life is suffering, number one. Number two, that we're caught in the world of suffering because of our craving or our desire. Number three, the only way out of desire and craving is through nirvana and the distinction of desire. And number four, we achieve nirvana by various forms, the eightfold path of right mindfulness. Make your own conclusions. What sort of view of humanness do you have? Are we free as human beings? No. Freedom is freedom from human individuality, because caught in this world is the world of illusion, samsara, transmigration, and so on. No freedom here. Freedom from here. And you could go on down the line, and you reach a view which is profound, which is sensitive, but which is essentially otherworldly, with its view of the answer to evil of one of detachment. Is that true? There are consequences. Or take another one, Shirley MacLaine in The New Age. Not the most profound, but maybe the most popular in America. Take her book, It's All in the Plain. Shirley MacLaine discovers that we are each God, tat tvam asi. So she says, she goes to a New Year's Eve party with this understanding that she is God. All the universe is there because she has willed it. All the problems are there because she hasn't resolved it. So she discusses in the book terrorism, the Vietnam War, the 55 mph speed limit, and all the sort of things that were happening back in the 70s when she wrote it. And she tells her fellow guests that this is all her responsibility, this is all her power, and if her New Year's resolution is to improve, she can improve the world. You just read it aloud, it's enough to answer it. Or take another one, Bertrand Russell. And I'm not meaning to make fun of her. You ever read his Free Man's Worship? Maybe the most clear-sighted, courageous statement of modern atheism there is. We came from a chance collocation of atoms. We will individually die. Not only that, all our human efforts will be reduced to extinction in the great rubble of the universe. So the only meaning in the world has to be built on, quote, the firm foundations of unyielding despair. So yes, we pass love. Yes, we show compassion. Yes, we give generosity. All these things, believe me, it is courageous. All against the backdrop of meaninglessness. As one of his own best friends said to him, the objection to this position, and he shared it is too bad to be true. But I'm not mocking it. Those are the very words he said. Choose it. Or take the Christian faith. C.S. Lewis wrestles with why the Christian faith is both this worldly and otherworldly, and points out this almost unique tension, what he calls the blessed two-edged character of the Christian faith. It is this worldly. It loves mercy and builds hospitals. It appreciates literature and builds libraries and keeps alive the arts and all these things, so much so that you'd say, it's like Confucianism, it's a this worldly religion. But at the same time, a crucified Savior at its center. The knowledge that we're only passing through this world as pilgrims, and the world that's coming is the real world, and you go that way by itself, and you get something so otherworldly, it's almost like Buddhism. But it's both together. And that's why you have this extraordinary view of evil, that evil is real, but evil was not intended and is alien. An illustration. I live with a man in Switzerland to whom I owe much, a deep Christian thinker. And I remember one day we were told that a Christian leader in the U.S. had lost his teenage son in a cycling accident. And we were told he'd reacted remarkably well, even preached at the funeral, all things work together for good, and been stiff-lipped and full of hope. Schaefer was impressed and said, well, I'd be glad to talk to him. And when the man came, we all said hello, and we left them to talk in the study. 5 minutes later, we left the chalet. Swiss chalets have wood walls that are rather thin, and you can hear a lot. The man, far from being full of hope, was cursing and swearing and blaspheming. Why did God allow the death of his teenage son and so on? And pouring out the blackness. What did Francis Schaefer take into him? Among many things that he shared with him was that extraordinary passage in John 11. Jesus, a week from his own death on the cross, is invited to the tomb of his friend Lazarus, one of his good friends. And twice in the text it says, as he approaches the tomb of his dead friend, he was deeply moved. And the Greek is, he was furiously indignant. Why was he angry? 5 minutes later, he was back alive. He brought him back. Why was he angry? Because he saw in death the symbol of the evil which had ruined the world his father had made. It had not been made like this. It was not intended like this. It was alien. It was intrusive. It was abnormal. And he was furious without being furious at his father. So the Christian can see death. The Christian can see evil and can be outraged. Not like Albert Camus waving his fist at an empty sky, but knowing this was not the way the world was intended to be. And you can see whole tracts of understandings, whether theoretical or practical, in facing evil, open up because of the difference of a worldview with creation and fall, this worldly and otherworldly, and a view of evil at its heart that is alien. And yet freedom is in this world. Stage two. You make your comparisons. Stage three. Checking your bearings, a time for confirmations. When people really are drawn towards answers, the question comes, or should come, yes, this throws light. Yes, this gives answers. But is it true? Sadly, that's the one that many American Christians miss out. They have a problem. Christ is the answer. They believe. But they've never asked, is it true? Now, there's a number of reasons why this is so important for the Christian faith. One is simply that it's true to the Christian truths. God is personal in the biblical understanding, and being personal, he is trustworthy, and therefore, whether he is true or not is absolutely key to his character. God speaks, and when he speaks, the question is what he says true, and can that be checked out? But not only that, God enters the human world with all its gritty reality. So he takes wine at a wedding. And the wine he made could have had an alcohol content check for it. Blood poured down from his hands and his side, and you could have got his DNA pattern. He was crucified on a rough Roman instrument of execution, and you could have got splinters running your hands up that cross. This is not a Salvador Dali painting. This is not something worn around our necks as a fashion statement. It happened. It is true or false. It is in history or it's not in history. It is not in any way claimed to be a myth, but something which is objectively, absolutely true. Now, when people consider this, there are a number of stages they pass through even in this. One is there's clearly a time for disconfirmation in the process of confirmation. In other words, we're looking at all the answers. Some things clearly prove not true, and so only a few are left that even claim to be true. There's a wonderful poet in Zen poetry called Isa. He had five children and a wife, and tragically, one after the other, they all died. Each time they died, Isa was deeply moved and grief-struck, and he went to the Zen master, said, "How can I bear this?" And every time the Zen master said, "The world is due." Just remember, the world is due, D-W. Dew lies, the sun rises, the dew disappears, suffering is that transient and illusory. Be detached, withdraw from it. Remember, the world is due. But Isa's most famous poem came after he was just numb after one of them. And when the Zen master said it to him again, he went home and wrote a haiku poem which transliterated into English goes, "The world is due, the world is due, and yet." The logic of his philosophy, this way, the world is due, the world is due. But he was also a human being. He was a husband and he was a father. So the world is due maybe went that way, and yet cried out that way. And many people have read that poem and just been stopped in their tracks, seeing what it meant. Today, of course, truth is an obscenity. Certainly in American campuses, it's an obscenity. We prize diversity rightly. We prize tolerance, rightly understood, rightly. And in this climate, though, prizing all these things, we've gone to the side of relativism wrongly, and we have made truth an obscenity. And we all know situations where blood pressures rise and hostility rise as soon as anyone claims anything that's true, and yet the Christian faith claims to be objectively true. True, independent of every knower. So the truth is true even if nobody believes it. Lies would be lies even if everybody believes them, because truth is true. Now, you can get very complicated, as those of you in philosophy know, in terms of the understanding of this, but the best modern philosophy actually moves back remarkably close to common sense. That things are true when that which we claim fits what actually is. And that's certainly true of a Christian faith, true. You can see this with many searchers. For example, G.K. Chesterton, I mentioned earlier. As he searched, he wanted an answer where the optimism he felt and the pessimism he knew both fitted together. Because the world was odd. It wasn't just the world of the optimist. It wasn't just the world of the pessimist. Something had to fit together. And he said in his mind, it was as if the world had this big hole in it. And he was looking for a philosophy that had a spike that would fit the hole. And Chesterton describes how he explores the biblical worldview with its understanding of creation and fall and the best and the worst, the glory of human beings, the wretchedness of evil. And he said, it was as if my two machines fitted together. The spike went into the hole and the nuts and the bolts fitted in all down the line. Or as he puts it later, the bone fitted back in the socket. It was true, and his excitement was palpable. Later this week, you'll have Eleanor Stump even argues from the problem of evil to the truth of faith in a magnificent argument which she may give here. Or think of C.S. Lewis. Lewis, as he came to faith with his supercilious Oxford common rooms, was bugged out of his mind. He never used that word. It was annoyed out of his mind by all these people who'd pay lip service to the great moral teacher, Jesus. But what led Lewis to Christ? As he looked at the evidence, that didn't work. Here was this great moral teacher, so appealing to so many down the ages, great moral, deep teaching. And yet, this same teacher made claims, theological claims, to be equivalent to God, which if you took them seriously, he says, Lewis says, make Hitler look like a humble man. So megalomaniac are they. How did you fit these two together? Looking at the evidence. There's only one way, he said. You're forced to this threefold question. He's either mad, or he's evil, or he is who he says he is. The liar, the lunatic, or the Lord. And Lewis describes that night in the summer of 1929, when finally the most reluctant convert in all England, he got to his knees, hating to admit that he believed these things were true, true, true. Stage four, commencing the journey, a time for launching out. If you look at people actually starting as disciples of Christ, particularly those who think, you can see there is no formula. We like to reduce the church to a franchise and the gospel to a formula and sell them both. There is no formula. There's as much variety as there are human beings, as many ways to Christ as there are people who come to Christ, although he is the way to God. At the same time, you always see that this stage is the one of deep personal commitment. In other words, it's not just abstract propositional arm's length. It is mine, it is yours, or it is nothing. You can say this philosophically. This came home to me when I was reading of an Englishman who went out to Kenya and was doing some translation of some Christian stuff, and a Maasai warrior who was translating it for him said, "That's no use. Your word in English for faith," he said, "is rather like a white hunter, 200 yards away, shooting the animal. No danger. The only thing that's in play is a hand and an eye and a finger." "That's not faith," he said. "We Kenyans know what faith is. Watch that lion coming up behind and the great death leap as it pounces to kill, putting its arms, which is what they call the legs, round the animal and getting it." He said, "That is faith as you close on truth." Actually, the best modern philosophy from Michael Polanyi and others is very much there. Not the spectator view of truth, but a view of truth with deep responsibility and commitment. For Christian faith is knowledge that has matured into conviction, that has matured into trust. It's knowledge. We're not asked to believe in someone whom we know nothing about. It is knowledge. But it is conviction, because it is something about which we're not just attracted generally, but of which we are sure, because we are convinced it is true. And it is trust, because we're not just convinced of something, we are finally committed to someone. And then comes the amazing thing. We all discover at this stage, or most of us do, we haven't so much found the answer as been found by the one who is the answer. We set out searching, looking for something, and we found that we've been discovered by someone. "I would never have found you," said St. Augustine, "unless you were first seeking for me." Isn't this the Apostle Paul? God speaks to him. "Who are you, Lord?" The answer comes, "I am Jesus." "Who are you, Lord?" says this Jew, breathing fire against all followers of Christ. And the answer, "I am Jesus," brings the Lord and the Jesus together. And Paul is flattened at his feet. Isn't this the same for St. Francis? Cocksure, idealistic, rode out to battle and fell off his horse and came back, disgraced by that and disgraced by various other things he did. And he retreats to his cave, humiliated. The only word he can see, he says, is fool. But as he looks at the cave and thinks of how he'd been a fool, the word fool is transformed. And he sees that God's humbled him, turned him upside down, inside out, and he goes out to be a fool for Christ. He'd totally been turned around. And so one could go on. Now, of course, at that stage, there's always two options. And for everyone, it were, who searches with integrity and falls on their knees, there are others who see the same truth but turn on their heels. Both Chesterton and Lewis give many humorous but deeply serious illustrations of people at this stage with a string of excuses and evasions. Lewis himself said, "I was a swirl of contradictions. I maintained," he said, "that God did not exist, but I was angry with God for not existing, and I was angry with God for making the world that did exist." And you can see many people like this. Or as Lewis says, "I meet people, you explain the faith to them, and they say, oh no, you know, that's for a six-year-old. So you step it up a bit. The level of, oh no, no, that's far too complicated. If God were really like that, he'd make it simple. Now which way do you want it?" Chesterton goes around, "Some people are always saying the Christian faith is so realistic that it's morbid. Others that it's so heavenly-minded, it's totally Pollyannaish. People can't have it both ways." And yet at this stage, people are filled with excuses and evasions. As Lewis said, "Some people just say they don't need God, and they're rather like the woman after World War II, who said when she heard the bread shortage, that didn't bother her because her family ate toast." At a more serious level, though, Friedrich Nietzsche, who was an atheist and stayed an atheist and died an atheist, described this as the danger point. Nietzsche attacks his friend, the Swiss historian Burckhardt, because Nietzsche says he sees the danger point. In other words, he's prepared to say that God is dead, but he's not prepared to live the consequences. He says God is dead, but he goes on living as if everything's the same before, whereas Nietzsche at least had the courage and the consistency to look over the abyss and look into the face of nihilism. And many people said one of the reasons why he went mad. Compare that with Aldous Huxley. He believed in meaningless too. But in his book, Ends and Means, Huxley admits the sense of meaninglessness was, quote, "an instrument of liberation. Some people had meaning but had to follow a way of life. I said," he says, "there is no meaning so that I could be free to do whatever I liked." In other words, there's an intellectually, morally serious point here. We can either conform our desires to the truth, or, as many people have done, including many intellectuals, we can conform the truth to our desires. The one, in the short term, leads to repentance, but then to freedom. The other, in the long run, leads to rationalizations and then to various profound problems. So let me just give you this challenge as we finish. Some of you tonight are followers of Christ. And to you, I would say this: know why you believe what you believe. Bertrand Russell said with real reason, most Christians would rather die than think. In fact, they do. And that is one of the great tragedies of American Christian church. We have a rampant intellectualism, even in student circles, which is against the scriptures and totally unworthy. Know why you believe. Some of you tonight, though, are giving serious thought. And I would just say to you, don't fall for the modern notion that life is a journey and we're all searching and there'll be no end to the searching and better to travel, hopefully, than to arrive. Somerset Maugham tells the story of a king who thought he was wise, started off his life, took his wise men and said, "Get me all the wisdom of the world." And they went out for 10 years. And they brought back 5,000 volumes and said, "The wisdom of the world's here. Read this and you'll know how to live." "Too much," he said. "Reduce it. Go back again." They came back and came back with 100. And you remember the story. It eventually got down. They came back with one. But by then, the king was too old to read or care and had missed the point. Many modern liberal-minded are so open, searching hopefully better than to arrive, and will never reach the point of anything. Others of you are searching seriously, and to you I would simply say, make sure your desires are conformed to truth, not truth to your desires. Remember Walker Percy, you can get all A's and flunk life. Remember above all St. Augustine, you have formed us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. I'm only one person in 1,000, lived one tiny life, and had a few small experiences. but in the 35 years I've known Christ, I've never got to the bottom of the wonder and the joy of knowing Him and the difference that He makes in every part of life. There's no way like it. Don't miss it. There's no one like Him. Don't miss what He called the way, the truth, and the life. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, some of you will need to go. Please feel free to do so at any time. We're going to have a time of question and answers and discussion. I can barely see them. There are a couple of mics here. So if any of you want to raise a point, do feel free to go to the mic and raise the point. And we'll have a time of discussion while the interest is lively. Yeah. You could go to the other one if you want.
No, I'm fine. I am currently enrolled in an ethics course as an undergraduate, and just 2 days ago, the professor, this is my first philosophy course I've ever had, the professor claimed that people who are Christians have a circular reasoning in what they believe. He mentioned an obscure person by the name of Apollonius of Tyana as having all the same claims of Jesus, including all the miracles, raising from the dead, all the rest. Why shouldn't we believe in him instead of Jesus? And he wanted to know if anyone in the class could say why they believed in the claims of Jesus as being true. And it really caught me off guard, because I've believed for a long time, and I've been satisfied in myself, but I didn't really know exactly why. And I explained it the best that I could. I said that I believed in the validity of the scriptures, and he wanted proof of that, so I went digging through my books, and I'm bringing him proof, but I'm wondering if that's the right thing, or how I should respond to a challenge like that.
Mm-hmm. I don't know your professor, so I'm answering in the dark. No, but in my experience up and down many universities, professors know they're always at least one page ahead of the students. At least one, and many of them, several volumes ahead. So it's easy to pull rank. Secondly, many professors, as a matter of tactics, like to destroy all presuppositions in the class so that out of the scorched earth field, they can start to build whatever they want to build. And it's a useful thing to knock down everyone who's too sure of this or doesn't believe that for the wrong reason, and so on. It's a common tactic in many universities, that in the first classes, you just level. I'm not saying your professor's like that. He's probably far, far better, forgive me. But that's a very, very common tactic. Now, in that situation, I personally think those of us who are believers are often unwittingly sort of suckers. We love Christ. We don't want to be cowardly. So we come right out, this is what I believe, and et cetera, et cetera, and we get mown down. Actually, a much better way of biblical arguing is to hold back what we believe for the moment and to really start to get the professor or the student, whoever it is, person over coffee, to look at what they believe. Because they will never, ever consider the Christian faith seriously until they start to query their own beliefs. All they're doing at that moment is having fun knocking down ours, and I wouldn't give them the joy. Take, for instance, the problem of evil. Whenever anyone raises the problem of evil, I always ask to myself, is that a serious question? Some people, evil is just a stick to beat faith with. Others really want an answer. You only answer the second, not the first. So I would be wise. Jesus talked, and don't misunderstand this, of casting pearls before swine, and not for a second saying that your professor or anyone else is a swine. But there is a moment to say something, and there's a moment not to say something. And in those sort of opening classes, often is not the moment. Now, I don't mean be silent and cowardly. but engage what they believe, the rest of the class, the professor, whatever. And you don't have to have every answer. Let me give you a story. A number of friends of mine in the 60s came to faith in Christ out of the counterculture. Some of them had dropped out of Harvard, and when they came back to faith, went back to Harvard. And they had at Harvard Lewis Mumford as a course. Now, Lewis Mumford was a magnificent scholar, a grand old humanist of the best kind. And they knew, as young people, early 20s, young in the faith, a few months old, they weren't going to go in with C.S. Lewis type arguments to engage Lewis Mumford. So what they did, courteously, was prepare tough questions every week. And they went to his lectures having thought through questions that got down to the assumptions of his thought and forced him to examine this. Now, they didn't know the final outcome, but Mumford said at the end of that semester, he was taking a week off to go away and think through some of his positions which he'd not thought about since he was a graduate student. Because this class had been the most searching and honest and had pressed him back to first assumptions. Now, think where you began with all thinking is circular. Yes, you could argue, I would argue, that all thinking in the right sense is presuppositional. Now that means that all thinking is circular. The only alternative to a circle is a vicious circle. Now, you can get pretty complicated taking that further. I suggest you go to Eleanor Stump when she comes on Friday and her philosophy seminars. That's the deepest stuff behind that, which she will deal with. But there's a real sense in that, that all thinking is circular. Yes, sir.
My question is just that, a question. I consider myself fairly tolerant, and I don't wish to challenge anyone. I think that faith is a very good thing, regardless of its form. Imagine, if you will, that I am an animal.
I am an animal,
or an alien, perhaps. I exist outside the realm of human history, human experience. I have never seen a person. I have never spoken to one. I live on a distant planet, and I look up at a starry sky that is similar but different from this one. I am alone. Yet I believe in God. I believe in creation. I believe in perhaps the synonymy, if I'm using that word correctly, between God and nature, that they are one of the same, that nature includes the supernatural, simply because nature includes everything. This is a strong faith, a faith that brings strength, a faith that brings hope, and a faith that answers many questions, if not all, and can answer all. Yet this faith is independent of human history, it is independent of human belief, it is independent of specific faith, such as Christianity or Judaism, or insert your preference here. Am I believing in truth, or is my truth incomplete because I do not have what you as a person and what many people here as people believe the truth to be and hold as unquestionably true?
Three answers. No.
Twice better than one.
What? No, your question is a terrific one, and it opens up a whole many questions. There's a whole nest of things that are fascinating. And it'd be much more wonderful if we could sit down over a glass of wine and sort of explore this and explore that and, you know, and really look at it. So any answer like this in the public is terribly inadequate. You know, just quick things that are very inadequate to speak to certain things you say. But first, tolerance. Let me speak to that. Tolerance is infinitely better than intolerance. But it's actually a very sloppy term, which today often flip-flops into a kind of form of intolerance, and I personally don't use it. And I think other words like freedom of conscience and respect and things like this are much tougher terms. I understand what you are saying, but I'm very wary of tolerance because on the campuses, it becomes a kind of permissive, anything-goes apathy, which wipes out everything except a sort of form of relativism. Which leads to a second point. Differences really do make a difference. So you didn't say too much, and so it'd be sort of ungracious of me to pick on what you said, but you were hinting of a kind of pantheism. In other words, there's no difference between you and the animals and the world of nature and the world of the supernature, and God is the universe, and so on. Now, this is actually very common today. While in this room you might have a majority of Christians, I don't know. In America, you increasingly have a growth of sort of paganism and Gnostic forms of this once again. Now, I would say the difference between that and the Christian faith are very real, and those differences do make a difference. Now, I'm going to state this rather boldly, but pantheism, which often equates human beings and animals and nature, in the long run, rather than bringing the nature up to the level of human beings, i.e. we'll respect it more, brings human beings down to the level of nature, we respect them less. Unlike Christian theism, Judaism, the Christian faith are the same here, where you have a personal God, not an impersonal God of pantheism, a personal God who has made people in his image. So the human beings are like nature. You know, we have parts of us that are machine-like and run out and need fresh parts, and there are parts of us that are like the rest of creation. So we have an affinity. At the same time, we have a dignity because of our difference. And you find it's out of the personal theism of Judaism and the Christian faith and the scriptures that you have the inalienable dignity, say, lying behind Western rights. You would never have produced human rights from pantheism, because rather than raise nature to the level of human beings, you eventually lower human beings to the level of nature. Which would lead me to my third comment. At the end of the day, I'd make so bold, and since, you know, we haven't much time and one has to say things fast and rudely, I would say the real discussion between us is, is the worldview you're articulating sensitive and appealing as it is to many? Is it true or not? And I would argue at the end of the day, if we could talk long enough, I would argue it's not true. But I wouldn't argue it just as a kind of brittle thing. You believe this, I believe this, mine's true, yours is wrong. You know, a lot of argumentation just goes like that. Worldviews are things people get inside of and really live out. So you, if we discuss for 3 hours at your local pub here, you know, I might have raised a question or two in your mind. You might have put a question to me. Hopefully, I would have raised some to you. But the real disproof of what you're saying would probably come in the next 6 months. Some experience you have where something happens, you go, wow, I suddenly see what he was saying. If I live like that, and human beings are like animals, like nature, there's no personal God, everything's one, that is the consequence, and I see it. So I doubt it'd be a matter of a little, you know, we could expand this 3 minutes to 3 hours, we still wouldn't get there. The real test would be you're living out those ideas in life and suddenly saying, boy, that doesn't go. And to me, it matters. But thank you. What you're saying appeals to many people. And I think it's wrong. And I think it has effects. No, don't. Yes, sir.
Hi, I have several comments. Before I ask you your question, to the lady who had the professor, I would like to talk to you because that seems like a pretty interesting situation. Now, this whole forum is based on truth. You know, that's why we're here, because we want answers, for truthful answers that we can use in our lives and apply. And that's why you folks are here, correct? Well, truth needs no defense, number one. So for you to be able to have to defend your belief in God is wrong. Well, wrong in the sense that if it's truth, it needs no defense. If he's already determined in his mind that he didn't believe in it, you're not going to persuade him.
Do you want to make point by point? Can I answer that one? And you want to come back?
What's that?
Can I answer that one?
Sure.
I don't believe that.
Okay. Well, that's fine. That's fine. Everybody in here has...
Let me just say why. In a Christian view of the world, as soon as evil and lies and counterclaims come in, truth does need defending. So when the Apostle Peter says in the New Testament, be always ready to give an answer for the hope truth that's within you, the Greek word there is to give a defense, a legal court defense.
Right.
And the fact is that from the first sin till the time it's cleared up, God is being impugned. Truth is being impugned, and truth actually does need a defense.
Okay.
Now, truth is much bigger than us, so our puny defense is... Don't make a thing true. That's absolutely certain.
Right. I know what you're saying, that in the Greek it's the answer of truth in the face of accusation. I'm familiar with that. And with that, sure, I agree. But with the Word of God, if you've accepted that as your standard for your life, and like we got into this thing last night with a bunch of folks, we were talking
about... Speak a little louder.
We were talking about some stuff out in the back there, And sure, we gave an answer of truth in the face of accusation. That's right. That's not what I'm trying to say. Maybe I didn't explain myself very well. Sure. And another part of that verse is that we're both to confront and exhort and convince the gainsayers. That means we confront the word hashers. Now, the standard that's been given to us by God is just that, a standard for truth, for the truth. Now, you talk about Buddhism and this and that, the other thing. And you yourself said that Jesus Christ is the way, the only way. So that's the standard for truth that God has made available to us in this day and time. And if any of you folks want to know, that's where you're not, where you're going to find it. And you also mentioned something about you had a minister friend whose son got killed, and he preached at his funeral, and then he broke down upset. Why did God take my son away from me? Is that also your view that, because you said that he said, or I don't remember if it's him or you, all things work together for good to those who love him?
Absolutely. Romans 8 is absolutely right. But Romans 8 does not mean, when Paul says that, that everything that happens, God intended, God approves of, because evil above all is something we should hate too.
Right.
So you have in the scriptures and in the early church and down to today, mm-hmm. While hatred is wrong, God hates evil. So this, I think, is very psychologically important. I've met a lot of Christians who are just uptight because they believe that faith is repressive. What you feel, shock, hurt, anger, outrage, you know, is wrong. You've got to trust God, all is good. Mm-hmm. No. If Jesus was furious in the face of evil, I can be livid too and be on his side with his father against evil and not be against him.
Okay.
No, a lot of Christians believe if you feel that, you're angry with God, not at all.
Right. Okay,
you're
I just want to make sure.
God.
Okay, I just want to make sure I was following you, because I kind of got lost here. I'm like, gee, is he blaming God for killing his boy? Was that his point? Because you can't say that, because death is an enemy of God. So
exactly.
In the
interim one, when he was pouring out the blasphemy, he was blaming God, yes.
Right.
And he went from this repressed sort of God is good and everything's fine, to his real feelings, God's responsible. Because he didn't understand the biblical position that evil is alien.
Right.
Death is an intruder. So we can really feel its abnormality. The tragedy, say, of a Camus, the plague. You know, in the plague, Dr. Roux is fighting the plague, the bubonic plague, but it is so natural to the universe we have, you've no hope of overcoming it, and you're fighting what's normal. And in most of the religions of the world and the philosophies of life, evil is normal in some sense to the world as it is. And as soon as you say that, how can you feel that angry at it or hope to truly overcome it? But for the Christian, no, evil is not normal. God did not make the world like this. Evil is abnormal, and we are free to be outraged.
Sure.
That's an
sure.
incredibly liberating thing, philosophically, psychologically.
Sure. All right, thank you.
Sorry to interrupt at this time, but before we take any more questions, the ushers are now passing out comment cards. We'd appreciate if you'd take the next couple moments to give us some of your thoughts, comments, and questions. We'll be addressing some of your questions and comments in the Michigan Daily in the next couple weeks.
Hi, my name is Colette Cassidy, and I enjoyed your lecture.
I can hardly hear you.
My name is Colette Cassidy, and I enjoyed your lecture very much. It was very thought-inspiring. I just wanted to ask you to elaborate on a point you made at the end when you said that you need to conform your desires to the truth rather than conforming the truth to your desires. And the first one, you will reach freedom through that, and if you do the second, you will be rationalizing all of your life. And I'm just wondering, what exactly do you mean by freedom?
Freedom is to be who you are. You know, if I have a sort of 10-year-old boy who starts a freedom fighters club and goes down to the local zoo, and they see a tiger with a huge concrete hump put on its back, and next to it they see a camel with huge sort of thick rubber stripes painted all over it, and both of them sort of lumbering around listlessly, and they go up and say, now we're freedom fighters, we're going to free these two. What they would do, obviously, is free the tiger from the hump and the camel from the stripes, and not the opposite, because the camelness of the camel is in the hump, and the tigerishness of the tiger is in the stripes. Now, that's a ridiculous illustration. But that lies behind the philosophical notion that there are two types of freedom. Negative freedom is those who say, I'm freedom from tyranny, from my parents, from discipline, from this, from that. I'm just free when I'm free from, contentless freedom. Positive freedom is when I'm free for, freedom to be. So as Lord Acton put it, freedom is not the permission to do what you like, but the power to do what you ought. But that assumes what you ought is in line with who you are. Now, go back to conforming truth and desires. Take someone like C.S. Lewis, or many of us as searchers. When you're close to Christ, we do not want to believe. Some people want to believe with everything in them. Others do not want to believe. They are just brought to their knees by the truth, humbled, convinced, riveted. They'd give anything to believe this stuff, but they believe it because it's true. Their desire's not in it. That is repentance and the about turn that comes on the basis of it. The wonderful thing is, paradoxically though, for all the reluctance, when you discover the truth, it includes the truth of who we are. And then we have the freedom to be who we are, which is the positive freedom. Now, contrast that with Huxley. Conform the truth to your desires. I don't like the truth. I'll claim this is the truth because it allows me to do that. You can see this with many, even people like Freud, shading this and that at points like, well, you do that, in the short run, you're more free because you've rationalized the truth away. In the long run, your freedom is merely the negative time, freedom from. You have no idea who you are and the whole freedom for. And you can see with many of the stories of the 20th century's freedoms, they end up in addictions and disasters of one sort and another. So freedom very much depends on the discovery of what the universe is about, who you are. So you're free to be who you are. Do you want to come back?
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, yes. Thank you for a fascinating lecture. One of the things that really struck me was how many of your ideas are being talked in the political forum by Dr. Alan Keyes, the presidential candidate. And I was wondering if you could comment in terms of, I mean, politics is not something that we normally get involved with. I mean, religion and the separation of church and state. But your fourth stage seemed to indicate that, I mean, when you get involved with the truth, then you put your life into, I mean, you weren't very specific about exactly what you're trying to do. I know in Alan Keyes' view, what he's doing, he's running for president because he wants to raise the level of the moral debate. And I'm wondering if you could comment on what we are supposed to do. I mean, go ahead.
Two areas, again, by way of response. One is the public square. The other is our individual personal lives. I don't know Alan Keyes personally, but I know many people who are friends of his who deeply admire and respect him. Now, part of the reason he can be so free and so blunt and so clear is he hasn't a snowball's chance of getting anywhere. And the sad thing is, and he knows that, that's why he's raising the debate. The sad thing is how the higher you go, the more they are clueless. I mean, you've got candidates who really have no understanding of faith at all. You know, who truly, I think of a candidate who genuinely believes if you dismantle the state, all will be well. Another candidate who genuinely believes you just rely on the market, all will be well. I mean, the level of conservative utopianism in Washington at the moment is breathless. You know, so sadly, I like Alan Keyes very much. I wish that people at the higher level were that clear and that strong as he is, and not just his level. So I welcome that. People who know where they stand, why they believe what they believe, and are able to articulate it clearly and forcefully. Now, distinguish that, and here I make the second point, from what's called the public philosophy. The genius of America is that across all its diversity, ethnic groups, classes, races, languages, you name it, there has been a unity to balance the diversity, often called Americanism. Now that is severely frayed today. The big weakness of the Christian right, among about 15 weaknesses, is they have never understood what the public philosophy is. So every time they press their agenda, they appear threatening to the Jews or any other small minorities. rather than saying, we respect the common vision for the common good. This is what we want here, but I respect your rights as Jews, your rights as whatever, and really be seen to be standing for that. As one Jew said to me in the 80s, Christians talk of justice, and they sound like just us. And that's true of the Christian right. Now, that doesn't mean we don't have beliefs and we don't express beliefs, but we make sure that when we make our beliefs clear and strong, we are always respecting other people's beliefs too. I was involved with a constitutional celebration of the bicentennial of the Constitution called the Williamsburg Charter. And one of its simplest principles was that everyone respects the rights of others. Christians respect the right. A right for a Christian is a right for a Jew, is a right for a Muslim, is a right for a humanist, is a right for a Mormon, and for the believer of anything under the sun. Believe it or not, I used to get death threats from some of the Christian survivalists who are way beyond the right of the Christian right, because they did not want to give rights to people they disagreed with in belief. Now, they made very simple errors of logic. I put it like this. The right to believe anything is a matter of freedom of conscience. But the idea that anything anyone believes is right is just plain nonsense. But many people think the first entails the second. So if they have respect in a pluralistic society, they are accepting relativism. So I would accept the right, within constitutional limits, of the person who believes in voodoo. And there are constitutional limits, thank God. Having said that, I am free to differ with them, the same with a humanist. In other words, I may think someone's view is nonsense or evil or just plain ridiculous. You know, then I have to disagree with them civilly and peacefully and persuasively. So we have to work this out, make a distinction between clear personal views, and we have wisdom in saying those in certain contexts, and then the respect for the rights of all others in a pluralistic society.